Good morning, church. Welcome to this place. Thanks so much for dusting off your cars and trudging through the snow to make church happen this morning. Blessed to be together with you. Deacons, come on down. We're going to go ahead and take our offering. So if you guys would come and serve us, thanks for doing that. If you are new, if you're a guest, thanks, a special welcome to you. Thanks for coming. If you have any questions about anything, about who we are, what we do, how to get connected, anything else, Brock and Jenna are at the welcome table in the back and would love to make the acquaintance. So just go ahead and see them after the service. Just a couple things to bring to your attention. In 2 weeks, we got our men's breakfast coming up. Unfortunately, signups are closed for that. We had to cap it at 50 men just for space reasons, and that's full. But more of these things coming up. So guys, next time, sign up quicker. But for those of you that have signed up, in 2 weeks, that's going to be happening. Also, ladies, on April 14th, you're going to have an event here called Gethsemane, which is to kind of prepare your hearts for Easter, which will be 1 week later. And then, it's happening. Easter's coming up in 3 weeks on April 21st. So just be mindful of that. I'm not sure why I announced that, but just know that it's coming. Okay, so now that we've got that, we're going to continue in our series called Blessed. And ask you to turn in your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 6. That's where we're gonna camp out this morning. We were there last week. We'll be there again this week. And we'll kind of ping-pong a little bit back and forth between Isaiah 6 and Matthew 5, where we're going to continue in the Beatitudes. Okay, so as you're turning there, I'd love to take you back in time about 20 years-ish. To the night when I met Megan for the very first time. It's a special night, yeah. So fun. Okay, so I had some friends that were going to hang out at a party, and I kind of just went along with them. And the person that was hosting this get-together was working at a restaurant where Megan was working, right? And so Megan got invited to this thing, and I got invited to this thing, and then we were both at this thing, right, in this person's house, and it was crowded, whole bunch of people, all different rooms, just kind of hanging out. And then I don't think I ever remember meeting Megan until there was this one moment where I have my first cognizant like memory of her. And it was where the host of the party, who worked with Megan at the restaurant, gathered a bunch of people in the living room, said, "Hey, you got to come into the living room because my friend is an incredible singer." And apparently she had like been coercing Megan to sing a song for everybody. And she quiets everybody down, right? And I've never been to a party where this has ever happened before. Where like everybody, shh, we're going to have a song, right? But it happened here. And so I'm looking at Megan for the first time. Like I'm standing here in the room. She's right over there, like on the other side of the couch. I can still see it. And then Megan just started like just singing, right? And my first thought was, girl can sing. Wow, who's that, right? And I met her that night, and then I was out, right? And then I left. Now, for the next 6 months, if you were to ask me and say, "Brian, tell me something about Megan," you know what I would have said? Girl can sing. You guys got it. You nailed it. That's what I would have said, because from that first interaction that I had right across the crowded room where she's singing her song, I don't even remember like more than like one or two very small interactions with her. I didn't learn anything new about her. What I knew about her was she can sing. So when you ask me, tell me about her, I'm going to tell you the most important thing or the coolest thing that I know. Girl can sing. Now, 19 years later, having been in relationship with her for quite some time, you ask me the question, "Brian, tell me about Megan." I'm going to start listing some things. Let's just even say the top three things. In the top three things, I'm not going to say Megan can sing. Because in the last 19 years, I've learned a lot of other things that in my mind are more important about her. They're more true. They're more indicative of who she is. They speak to more of who she really is than girl can sing. Now, she can still sing just as well as she has ever sung before, but that's no longer prominent in my mind because so many other things about her have replaced that thing. Last week, Isaiah had an encounter with God, and he noticed something right out of the gate, similar to how I noticed something right out of the gate with Megan. And it's interesting that this week, Isaiah is going to notice something else about God. And regarding the thing that he observed in God last week, the thing that Isaiah is going to see this week is going to grow and actually be more prominent than the thing that Isaiah saw in God last week. Okay? Last week, Isaiah sees a vision of the Lord in Isaiah 6. And the first thing that he notices is that the train of his robe filled the temple. We talked about this last week, right? The back hem, little part of his robe, filled the whole space where Isaiah is, which means the first thing that he notices is that God is big, right? Wow, kind of big. So Isaiah, who had been a prophet, had known some things about God, right? He understood some things, and he thought he kind of had God sized up and figured out. But then he has a vision of him, and he says, whoa. The back part of his robe filled the whole temple. Wow! He's big. He's magnificent. I never thought he could be this. Wow. Okay? God is big. This week, as we continue in the story, Isaiah is going to see something else that kind of makes him, it puts God's bigness in perspective because this thing that he's going to uncover about God is more than. It's more true of him. It's more important about him than the back hem of his robe filled the temple. God is big. Wow. Okay? We're going to see that in Isaiah chapter 6. Now, just real quick, what we see in Isaiah 6, this new thing that Isaiah is going to see that is more important about God than the fact that God is big is going to help illuminate for us the next beatitude that we're digging into this week, which is Matthew 5:4. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. What does that mean? Go back to Isaiah 6 and let's start digging into it. It will make sense. Isaiah chapter 6, verse 2. Okay, Isaiah has, he says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on the throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Wow, he's big. The vision continues, right? Here's new material starting in verse 2. Above him, above the Lord, were seraphs, right? Or these magnificent angels. Above the Lord were seraphs, each with six wings. With two wings, they covered their faces. With two, they covered their feet, and with two, they were flying, right? So these are amazing creatures. Now, it's interesting, when you read the scriptures, anytime a human being encounters an angel, one thing always happens, another thing sometimes happens. The first thing that always happens is that the people who meet the angel, they freak out. Like, whoa, too much. Wow, I'm scared, okay? Whenever you're in the presence of an angel, you freak out. And the second thing that sometimes happens is that the person who sees the angel wants to bow down and worship the angel, okay? Because there's something magnificent about the angel that they've never encountered before. Okay, so now here we have at least two seraphs that are flying around the throne room of God, which says to me these are high-level, high-ranking angels, right? These are like cream of the crop, top of the chart, amazing, amazing angels, okay? And Isaiah just tries just a little bit to describe them, right? So, and they're flying around the throne of God constantly, which is a special place. Now, these angels have a high level of understanding about a whole lot of things. They see things on levels that we don't see. They understand things that we don't understand because of their proximity to God, because of who they are, because of their stature and their status, right? There's some stuff about these angels that puts them in a place to know they know some things. Be curious. If you were to ask these seraphs, hey, guys, you're around the throne of God constantly. Tell me about God. What's the most important thing about God? First time I meet Megan, I say, girl can sing. Now I say different things, right? Because I know some more. These guys know some more about God. Seraphs, tell me about God. What is he like? What would they say? Here's what I think they would say, because here's what they're saying. Verse 3. And they, the seraphs, were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty." That's who he is. The whole earth is full of his glory. Now, the fact that there's a threefold repetition of the word holy is actually a big time point here. Right? It's a big time point here because we've talked about this a little bit in the past. Sorry if this is review for some of you. But in the Hebrew language, the way that they would communicate an extreme something, a supreme quality in someone, is they would use a repetition of a word. Right? They would use, so if someone were like tall, they wouldn't say, in the Hebrew language, they wouldn't say, "Wow, that person is really tall." They would say, "That person is tall, tall." Okay? Like for us, we wouldn't say that because we have other descriptive words to explain a superlative. So like if I'm talking to my kids and we see somebody who's tall, I'd say, "Hey, buddy, that person's super duper tall." Okay? Which in our language distinguishes tall from super duper tall, right? It's a different level. Super duper adds a superlative to it. The Hebrews didn't have super duper in their language. They didn't have very, they didn't have like all the words that we use to emphasize something that needs emphasis. So what they did is they would use the word twice to communicate, "Wow, that person's tall, tall." Not just tall, tall, tall. Wow, right? So here's an example from the scriptures, right? This is in 2 Kings 25, verse 15, right? It's talking about the people that are plundering gold from Jerusalem. And it talks about the gold that they plundered. And it says they came in and they plundered the gold. Now, it doesn't say gold in your translation, because you would read that and say, "Wow, there's a double print. Why they misprinted there and printed the word gold twice?" Well, no, in the Hebrew mind, that distinguishes gold. We all know what gold is. Gold, right? We measure it by the ounce. We can tell you how much it costs. We know gold. The writer is saying, no, they didn't just steal the gold. They stole the gold. So in 2 Kings 25, verse 15, we pronounce that. They stole the pure gold, right? They stole the gold that was on a different level of being gold, the real good stuff, right? That's how the Hebrews thought. So here, the seraphs, who know some things about God, right? They see some things that we don't see. Seraphs, tell me about God. What is he like, right? This is a Hebrew document here. Here's what they say. He is holy, one time. Holy, that's two times. Holy, three times. It's the only time in the scriptures where a word is used three times to describe anyone or anything, including God. Who is God? He's not just holy. He's not just holy. He is, right, first time ever, a triple superlative. He is holy. Holy, holy, wow. That's what's true about God, say the seraphs constantly as they're flying around the throne of his presence. When I was in seminary, I took a class in Isaiah, and one of our textbooks was a commentary written by a guy named J. Alec Motier. And I know that name because for the last 21 years, I continue to go back and reference that commentary because it's so good. Okay, so I want to take you to Isaiah 6. Here's what J. Alec Motier says about what's happening here regarding the angel saying, "Holy, holy, holy." Here's what he says. Quote, "Holiness is supremely the truth about God, and his holiness is in itself so far beyond human thought that a super superlative, three times holy, a super superlative has to be invented to express it." Okay? This is big. And then I'll paraphrase where Motir goes on from here, because I've read this chapter in his book multiple times in the last 20 years. And he goes academic. Let me condense it in normal language. Here's what Motir says, and this point has been so influential in my thinking for so long. Here's what he says. He says, regarding the scriptures, and regarding what we know as the fear of the Lord, or awe for God, right? It's a routine thing that happens. Isaiah is experiencing it now. The fear of the Lord is something that happens when we encounter him. Here's what Motir says. He says, the fear of the Lord doesn't happen because small, you and me, small is in the presence of big. That's not why the fear of the Lord happens. He says, the fear of the Lord is not small in the presence of big. The fear of the Lord is sin in the presence of holy. That's where the awe and the woe and the fear of the Lord comes from. Because as Isaiah is seeing now, right, this is, used to think God is big, that's true. Now something more important has been revealed. He is holy. That's where the awe and the fear of the Lord comes from. Right, in my early days, and I still think this is incredible, I used to love to teach on the magnitude of the universe, right? Because it's amazing. You just get out, just start doing some scientific facts about the speed of light, and to the moon it's 1.2 seconds, and then right to the sun, and you just scope out how big the solar system is. You realize, wow, the solar system is pretty big. And then from there, you like break out into the galaxy, and you're like, whoa, our galaxy has like 100 billion of these kind of stars, that the sun is our star. And then you realize, oh, there are 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and then there's 180 to 100 billion galaxies in the known universe, but there's more beyond that. Right? I used to love that point, because what that point communicates is that God is big, right? Essentially, that's our way of saying the train of his robe filled the place. Wow, I used to think I understood him. Bam, now I don't. Small in the presence of big, right? And that's a true thing. And it does an appropriate thing to us, right? But this week, what we learn is that's good and that's true, but don't stop there, right? Because the really important thing is that he is holy, 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 and that's way more important than he is big, right? We don't hear he's big, big, big. We hear he's holy, 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 right? So that's a new thing that we got to lean into here. This passage makes us do it, okay? Now, verse 4, Isaiah's vision continues. He says, at the sound of their voices, these angels that are constantly just singing praises to the Lord, holy, 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 at the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. Okay, there's quite a scene going on here as Isaiah experiences it, right? And so he sees like the magnitude of God. He's now hearing of his holiness, and the whole thing's happening. The place is filled with smoke. Now Isaiah is going to respond, right? Now Isaiah is going to give us a sense for what he's feeling, what he's going through in the presence of this God who is wow. Right? Here's what he says, right? First words out of his mouth, verse 5. Woe to me, I cried. I am ruined. That's quite a response. Woe to me, I am ruined. Okay, what this is not small in the presence of big. Woe to me. This is sin in the presence of holy, holy, holy. This is not small in the presence of big. This is darkness in the presence of a light that is overwhelming him. Like God's white, hot holiness is radiating out. And now that's the thing that is causing Isaiah to just shrink back and say, whoa, woe to me. I am ruined, right? I didn't know this about God. I didn't know this about you. I didn't understand this, right? And now that he does on a whole new level, it's causing him to see himself in a whole new way. He's lamenting his own condition. He's mourning himself now that he has seen God. Blessed are those who mourn. for they shall be comforted. Blessed. Also translated happy. Blessed are. Also meaning those who are in a favored position, a highly favored position. Blessed are those who mourn. Does this seem like a good thing to you? Is this good? Let's ask the question. Can we ask an honest question? Isaiah says, "Woe to me," I cried, "for I am ruined." How can this be good? What in there is positive, right? I don't see any positive self-help books that the title is "Woe to me, I'm ruined," right? Read inside for more. No, we don't buy that book. It's not out there. Nobody's got that book on their shelf. How is that a state of blessing? How is this? "Woe to me, I cried, I am ruined." How is that a position of highly favoredness? How? Great question. We'll get there in just a couple of minutes. Okay, but we got some more things that we've got to move through. He continues, "Woe to me, I cried, I am ruined." This is what he says next. "For I am a man of unclean lips." Right, what Isaiah does here, we've talked about this last year. Isaiah truth tells his location. Right, he was a man of unclean lips 15 minutes ago. Before the vision happened, he was all the same things that he was. Nothing's changed about him, right? But now, somehow, because he's seeing the trifold holy God, and he's in his radiant presence, and the smoke is everywhere, and the angels are calling out, and the doorposts are shaking, and the radiant light is blinding him. Now, suddenly, he's aware of his uncleanness in a way that he was not 15 minutes ago. He's the same guy, but he's in a different sort of place now where who he is being exposed in a way that it wasn't being exposed 15 minutes ago, yesterday, last week, right? It's all coming out now. It's happening now. "I'm a man of unclean lips." And then he continues, right? Then he says, And I live among a people of unclean lips. Everybody I live with is just like me. Woe to me, I am ruined. I am a man of unclean lips. Oh, and so is everybody else that I've ever met, right? "And my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Now notice here. Last week we talked a lot about patterns. Patterns are very important. Here's a new pattern for us. Here's a pattern that I want us to see this week. I want us to notice this. That when God shows up in his presence, right? We're not just talking about God, not speculating about him, not like writing articles about what he must be like. Okay. When God shows up and reveals himself, here's the pattern. Number one. You become aware of your own stuff. "Woe to me," I cried. It's a personal pronoun. "I am ruined." Personal pronoun. "I am a man of unclean lips." Right? When God makes himself known, first and foremost, we see our own stuff. Okay? Then, secondarily, next, we notice and we recognize the sin of everybody else around us, right? We're all in the same boat. We're all in the same space, in the same place. None of us are getting off the hook. But the pattern is my stuff first, other people's stuff second, okay? This is really important for us to linger here for a moment because what I know about us, including myself, is that what we like to do is we like to be very cognizant of other people's sin first, and then my sin, fifth or sixth, okay? Maybe second, right? Other people's sin first, my sin second, or somewhere down there. That's what we like to do. That's what we normally do. Now, there's two magnificent problems with that, right? Really serious problems. Here's the first problem. The first problem with seeing other people's sin first and my own sin second is this. That's not what happens when God shows up. Which means if I'm living that way, I'm not living my life in God's presence. Which is a dangerous thing. Okay? There's a whole bunch of things that will inspire me seeing your sin first and mine second. Okay? A moral code can show up and present itself in the room. And I can read that moral code and I can say, whoa, y'all are messed up. First, me, yeah, I violated that too. I'm second. I'm in there somewhere, right? A moral code shows up. You can be a sinner. I can be like next in line, okay? A religion can show up. I can read that thing and understand it and say, whoa, y'all are messed up. That's the biggest thing I'm seeing right now. You guys are terrible people, right? When religion shows up, your sin can be first, my sin can be second, right? When my pride or my arrogance is the main dominating influence in the scene, when my arrogance is center stage, that is sufficient for me to say, y'all are sinners, number one, you're the problem. Me, maybe there's some stuff that I need to own, but really it's like a lot less than you, okay? There's a whole bunch of things that will inspire a cognizance of your sin first, my sin second. There's only one thing that I know of that has the power in its presence to make me cognizant of my sin first and then your sin second, and that is when God shows up. When the holy, 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 radiant one presents himself, that is the only thing that I know of that is sufficient for me to see myself as I am, first and foremost. Woe to me, I cried, I am ruined. I, me, personal pronoun, man of unclean lips. That's who I am, I can't hide it. Oh, and then secondarily, y'all are messed up too, okay? God's presence is the only thing sufficient to provoke that or to make that a reality. Now, let me illustrate that for a second. Go back in time, depending on how old you are. You might have to go back in time longer. If you're younger, maybe not so long. But remember back in the day when you're a kid and it's like Saturday morning and you're sleeping and it's dark in the room, maybe the blinds are pulled down and there's no light on, but it's still like noon outside, right? You know, but somehow you still think it's dark. And then somebody walks in and then like flips the lights on and opens the curtains and what's your response? Whoa, come on. Like, you're hiding, right? Because why? Because you've become accommodated to the darkness. Your eyes are used to it being dark and you've kind of grown comfortable there. So when the lights flip on and the curtains come on and the light floods into the room, your first response is, whoa, ow, man, that hurts. And then maybe, I hate you, turn off the lights, close the curtains, right? But that's your response. Now let's imagine, here's why this is important. Let's imagine for a moment that you're not the only person sleeping in the room. Let's say you've got a sibling here, maybe you had a friend spend the night, and there's the two of you in the room, you're sleeping, it's dark in the room, and it's noon, okay? It's not just you anymore. Somebody walks in, flips the lights, opens the curtains, the light streams in. Here's what I know you're not gonna do. You're not gonna crawl up out of bed and say, hey, you're hurting their eyes! You catch that? You are not, like, your first response is not, hey, that's rude, you're hurting their eyes right now, close the windows, turn off the lights, right? You're not thinking about them, you're not considering them, your thoughts are not for what they're going through or for their position, for where they're at. That's not how it works, right? At best, this is it. Lights come on. Wow, ouch, stop it. Hey, and they're probably feeling the same thing. Right? That's the order. I'm feeling it first, and then if you're aware of other people, hopefully you are, ow, and they've got to be feeling it too. Close the curtains, turn the light off. That's just the way that it works. When we encounter the high and lifted up one, in all of his shining, radiant, brilliant, blinding holiness, when he's present, I see my stuff first and everybody else's second. And if that's not true of us, then we need to ask the question, in whose presence am I living? in whose presence might I not be living? The pattern's pretty powerful, and it's undeniable. Okay? Here's the second reason why it's a problem when we see others sin first in our own second. Second problem. When we become aware of other people's sin above our own, we tend to become judgmental people. Okay, if I'm aware of your sin as big and prominent, that's the thing that I see first and my sin second. If I live in that space long enough, I will necessarily and absolutely, I will become a judgmental person. Right? In Matthew 5:4, Jesus does not declare, "Blessed are the judgmental people, for they shall dot dot dot." Right? Jesus doesn't affirm people who judge other people according to their sin. Actually, what Jesus says is, he says, don't judge. Don't look at their sin first and your second, right? Don't, because when you judge, the standard that you're holding other people to, like, God is actually going to hold you to that standard. You don't want that, okay? Jesus doesn't say, happy are, blessed are, in a highly favored position are those people who are judgmental, for they will receive good things. Jesus never utters that. Yet why is it that we feel so confident in being that? Right? It's because we're not living in his presence, right? There's a problem here, right? Blessed are those who, not who are judgmental. Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn. Mourning is what happens when we see the high and lifted up holy God and we're blinded by his radiance, and then in his presence, we finally see the many ways that we have accommodated ourselves to the dark realities around us, and we recognize the specific places where we are sinners, and we say, woe to me, I am ruined. Mourning happens when we see ourselves before God first. It was Isaiah's experience, right? We just read this. Isaiah says, I, personal pronoun, am a man of unclean lips. I see my sin first, and I see, right, and I live among a people of unclean lips. He also recognizes everybody else's sin. The Apostle Paul says the same thing. Paul says, right, because Paul lives his life in the presence of God. So here's what he says. Paul says, I am the chief of sinners. I'm numero uno. Okay? Why does Paul seems like a pretty good guy? He's like, truthfully, he's living better than everybody else around him. He's not sinning any more than anybody else. He's actually, if we were to quantify it, he's sinning less than everybody else around him. So is Paul lying to us when he says, I am the chief of sinners? No, Paul is declaring the truth that he who is living in the presence of a holy God, not just holy, but a holy, holy, holy God, he in his presence is so cognizant of his own stuff because God's light is constantly shining on him. I am the chief of sinners, right? And then every other letter that Paul writes lends credibility to the truth that he believes that everybody else is a sinner too, right? You read Paul's letters and he's calling stuff out. You say, well, Paul, don't be judgmental. No, he's not. He's not being judgmental. He is from his own position of I am the chief of sinners. Then he comes along and he says now, right, because we're all living in the presence of a holy God, he says, my call is to exhort you and to encourage you and to teach you, right? I'm a man of unclean lips and you also are people of unclean lips. Here's what God's saying to us regarding our uncleanness. Here's what he wants to do, Colossians. Corinthians, here's what the Spirit of God is saying to you, right? Ephesians, the Spirit, you're unclean in Ephesus. Here's what the Spirit of God is saying. He's not judging them. He is exhorting and encouraging them as a chief of sinners individual who also happens to be able to see their sin. Okay? It's not wrong for us to see the sin in other people. We need to. You can't be in relationship with someone unless you're allowed to see their sin and call it out, right? But the thing here is you got to get this right. If you're seeing somebody else's sin first and your second, you're going to be a judgmental person that nobody wants to live with. Nobody's going to like you. You're going to be intolerable, right? The more you walk that path. God says, don't do that. But what he does say is, right, see your stuff first. Only God can do that for you. And then, right, your stuff first, their stuff second. Deal with your own stuff. Mourn your sin. Lament the tragedy that is still who parts of you are before him. And then you can address the people around you, right? Or as Jesus would say later, take the log out of your own eye first. And then you will be in a position to have an authentic conversation about somebody else's speck of sin in their eye, right? This is absolutely huge. So there's danger here, right? If you are a judgmental person, constantly aware of everybody's sin around you, but not very aware of your sin, right? Sirens and warning lights got to be going off like crazy for you right now. Right? Because what Isaiah would say, what Paul would say, what the scriptures are declaring is that you need to have a God encounter right about now. Because the path that you're on is going off a cliff. It's not going to good places. There's no blessedness there. The blessedness is getting in front of him and just, wow, I am ruined. I am unclean. That's the truth. That's where the blessing comes, mourning and lamenting you and your stuff in front of him. There's the blessing. That's where the good begins to happen. Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn, for they, and only and uniquely they, will be comforted. Comfort is good. When God is shining, when the lights come on and you're, you're desperate for comfort in that moment. Let's see what that comfort looks like. Back in Isaiah 6. So he has the experience. He's seeing all the things about God. His holiness is overwhelming him. And then this happens. Then one of the seraphs, these magnificent angels, then one of the seraphs flew to me, right? The seraph is coming to Isaiah with a live coal in his hand, which he, the seraph, had taken with tongs, because you can't touch it. He took it with tongs from the altar. Verse 7. With it, he touched my mouth and said, see, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin is atoned for. That's some comfort. After Jesus' resurrection, Jesus is walking with a couple of his disciples on the road. And his disciples are, they're not one of the 12 disciples, but they're one of his two of his followers. And they're not aware that the resurrected Jesus is walking with them, right? Because they think Jesus is dead. They're dumbfounded. It's dark out. They don't know what's going on. But Jesus, it says, is walking with them side by side down this road. And they're sad and they're upset and they're trying to get their head around, I thought Jesus was the Messiah. I don't understand why he had to die. This doesn't make any sense. What in the world is going on? And then I think it's John that tells us, he says, Jesus begins to speak to them, but they don't know that it's Jesus. And then as Jesus is speaking, what he does is he goes through the whole Old Testament and he points out for these guys why the Messiah had to come and suffer and how everything in the Old Testament was pointing forward and fulfilled in Jesus, okay? And then later they recount that while this person, they didn't know it was Jesus, is telling them how the whole Old Testament is pointing forward and is fulfilled in Jesus, they said their hearts were burning within them while the Old Testament was coming alive as they started to understand who Jesus was and why he came, right? So here's the deal. We're sitting in small group last week, and Nelson, who's new to our group, just fresh up from Puerto Rico through Cincinnati, moved to Akron, find our church. We're sitting in small group, and Nelson drops a theological bomb on all of us in the living room. We're like, whoa. Here's what Nelson said. He said, right, regarding this everything Old Testament fulfilled in pointing to Jesus, he said these seraphs, they come and they take the live coal from the altar. What's the altar? The altar is the place where God's wrath is satisfied, where the sacrifices are offered. The seraph takes a coal from the altar, delivers it to Isaiah, and then this is his response. Your guilt is taken away and your sin is atoned for. Right? We're like, He just dropped Jesus on us in Isaiah 6. We're like, wow, right? So Isaiah has an experience with Jesus, right, before the death, before the resurrection, like pictured in this coal that is taken from the altar. God is taking the initiative to satisfy, to cover him, to take his guilt and his sin in the very moment where he's like, wow, I can't take it, I'm ruined, right? It's immediate. And Isaiah says, I am a man of unclean lips, right? He specifically truth tells, here's what I see about myself now that I'm seeing you, right? My lips, everything in me is corrupt, and everything I say shows it, and it comes on out, right? He declares his lips are unclean, and the seraph brings the atonement, the covering, the sacrifice for sin, and covers the very place where he knows he's messed up, right? And that's beautiful that God does that, right? And he doesn't take an hour to do it. It doesn't take a month. God doesn't let Isaiah linger here for 10 years of woe to me, I'm ruined, what am I going to do, right? Isaiah's not cowering before the presence of God for years and years and years because God likes it when we feel tragic about ourselves and we're in a constant state of mourning. No, it's immediate. As soon as he says it, the seraph goes and grabs the coal and comes and touches him. And Isaiah goes from this to comfort, right? Oh, he mourns his sin. He feels it deeply, unapologetically, can't hide it. And then immediately, God brings the solution. From the altar of God, his covering is granted, his sin atoned for, forgiveness is his. Comfort is now the new reality for Isaiah. There it is. Now we've got some options this morning. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted, right? That's an option for us. It's Jesus' way. There are other paths that are available to us, right? You don't have to take the path of mourning in the presence of God. You don't have to do that. Here's some other options I'll put out there just so you can consider some other paths, right? Instead of mourning your sin before God, what you could choose to do is you could choose to hide from God. Blessed are those who hide from God, right? There's his holiness. Whoa, I got to get out of here, right? It was an option for Adam and Eve. That's what they did. Man, they're lickety-split on out of the garden, getting away from him. But there's no blessedness in hiding. There's no happiness. There's no supreme favor when we hide from God because of our sin. That's not what Jesus has for us, although it's an option. Here's another option for us, right? In the presence of God is trifold holiness erupts on the scene. What we could choose to do is we could choose to pretend that we're not so bad. Blessed are those who pretend they're not really as bad as they are, for they shall feel not quite so bad about themselves. That's an option, and most of us take that regularly, don't we? Can we tell the truth? Here's another option. Blessed are those who spend so much time looking and analyzing everybody else's faults that they tend to forget their own. Okay? You could take that path, but Jesus says that's not the blessed path. That's not the happy way forward. That's not the path of supreme favor. But it's an option, right? Here's one last option for you, just so you can go out of here with some decisions to make. You could, right? How about this? Blessed are those who try to do a ton of good to cover up all the bad they've done. For theirs is fill in your blessing, right? You could spend your life aware of your sin, aware of your junk, and just trying to just do good and do more good and get this done and try to do that, right? To make yourself feel better, like somehow maybe you're doing more good than bad. You could live your life. That's an option for you. But Jesus says that is not the path of blessedness. That is not the path of supreme favor. There's no happiness or lasting peace on that road, even though we try to take it so much. Why do we do that? Why? Our call is to mourn our sin and our stuff in the presence of the holy God and to just tell the truth. In God's presence, our sin is clear, so admit it, own it, and mourn it. First for ourselves, secondarily, we mourn everybody else's sin. And he, for those who choose that path, he has promised to bring comfort. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Let's pray. Father in heaven, tempted to fall on my face before your holiness and to say, woe is me. But Father, I think in these moments I am more tempted to fall on my face before you and say, woe is me. You are too kind. You are too loving. You are so gracious. I had no idea that you were this good, that you could love us this much, that you would show us this much favor. God, that you would look at us and see us as we are, and you would simply ask us to see ourselves in your presence, and that for a moment, in their varying moments through our lives, God, where we just have to say, woe is me, I am messed up, I am the problem, I walk in sin, I do things that I don't want to do, I don't know why, this is who I am. And in those moments, as we mourn and lament these things, God, you meet us at the specific place of our sin, and you bring a covering for us. You bring a healing for us. You bring forgiveness for us. You bring your presence in a way that doesn't have to keep freaking us out. You are still awesome, and you are amazing, and you are holy, but yet now we can stand in front of you because all the things that kept us from you in our sin, and because of your holiness, God, you've made a way for us to be there and to commune with you and to walk with you and to follow you down a path of absolute blessedness, of favor, of kindness, and of grace. God, you are altogether different than anything that we had ever drawn up or imagined, and we're so thankful that you are. Father, this week, would you give us the courage to walk the path of mourning and lament before you, and to reject all the other pseudo-spiritual paths, the paths of nonsense, Father. Give us by your Spirit the power to just reject those paths and to cling a hold of you and to be in your just your radiant, holy, glorious presence and just to say, woe to me, but yet I am covered. My sin is atoned for and I can be here because he loves me. God, take us to that place now. Take us to that place this week. Help us to follow you in your beautiful, blessed path. We need you to do it because we can't. Guide us on, Great Shepherd. We're happy to be your sheep. We love you in Jesus' name. Amen.